afternoon. This is Mike Vandervoort. It's Drive Through HR. This is Friday, March 27th. We're wrapping up a great week, and have a guest here that's a friend of mine and somebody I've known for a while, has been active in SHRM and many other places. A little bit different topic for Drive Through. We're going to talk labor relations at a very deep level today. I'd like to introduce Jim Gray. Jim, thanks for being on Drive Through HR. How are you today?
Doing well. Thank you, Mike, and good morning or good afternoon, depending on where all of you are. Again, I'm Jim Gray. For 13 years, I've been the owner and operator of a consulting practice, an HR consulting practice called Jim Gray Consultants, LLC. It's based in Charleston, South Carolina. I have over 160 clients. My primary focus is on union avoidance, but we do a few other things, general HR, executive coaching, positive downsizing, a publication we have coming out soon. We do general cultural transition as well. For 30 years, I was a practitioner. Half of my experience was as an industrial engineer. The other half was as an HR executive. I am a past member of SHRM's labor panel and frequently quoted in HR magazine. I have the honor of having had presidential and governor commission appointments. I currently serve on a number of boards. In 1994, I was named South Carolina HR Professional of the Year. If you ever need to reach me, my email address is jimgrayconsult@aol.com. Gray is spelled G-R-A-Y. My website is real simple, jimgrayconsult.com.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
Quite an impressive resume, which I knew, and I'm on the same labor as special expertise panel with SHRM now, as you were on a few years ago, and I can tell you that Mike Aiken, who I just saw this week from SHRM Government Relations, mentions your name quite frequently as a contributor to SHRM, both past and present. So that's great to be able to have connections like that. Listen, Jim, normally we have a format on Drive Through where we kind of ask, you know, kind of open-ended questions, but you and I both work, you know, have worked together and done some things over the years in labor relations, and you have such an interesting set of topics that I'm going to kind of ditch the general questions, and I'm going to ask you if you'll walk us through some quick discussion about a bunch of NLRB related or labor related topics, because it's really really in the news, and the first one I think is going to be just this week, and this was the topic of quite a bit of discussion at SHRM Ledge, was the general counsel for the NLRB, Richard Griffin, released a 30-page memo about employee handbooks and guidelines. You want to tell us what that's about and how that might impact HR folks?
Sure, Mike, and I think the audience needs to know, if you haven't already, you need to find on the web not only the actual guidelines from the NLRB, but there are a number of legal reviews, legal opinions, and I think SHRM has a summary as well. So I won't go through all the details, but I think the audience needs to know that generally the NLRB has shifted from regarding handbooks. Language was considered acceptable if the average person would not consider a statement to be something like protected activity. Now they've kind of drifted away from that average person, and they're going a direction of, if there's any plausible or even an extreme interpretation of something that could be compromising an employee's protected activity, they're going to be looking for that information, reviewing your handbooks during audits or during a campaign. And if they find something that they interpret as being something that could be compromising to considered or protected activity, they will consider that a violation of potential ULP. So I think because it's changed so much, some statements we used to make in handbooks that seemed common, now the rules are somewhat counterintuitive. And just to give you an example, having discussions about a supervisor's review is ever being confidential, just is not anymore. Wide open, I think most of you know that as far as social media is concerned, how aggressive employees can be in criticism of the company and of supervisors, and oftentimes consider protected activity. The little bit of a silver lining in their guidelines is they do give you some guidelines as what would be considered legal, and that gets into things like that would be violations of company secret information, protected information, as you if you will. So I encourage you all to consider a handbook review by your employment and labor attorney, and also to review the guidelines, because I think you could probably find questionable areas in your own handbook, and it's a good idea to do that. It's very timely. The guidelines are out now. Highly recommend you do that.
I heard several attorneys and some pretty well-known practitioners at Sherm Legislative this week make the general statement that there wasn't a single person from a company at that conference who had a compliant handbook under this new memo guidance memo from the NLRB General Counsel, unless you were Wendy's, which is the company that was used as the model for what they consider to be compliant practices. They worked in a settlement from Wendy's. So allegedly, there's only one company in the whole country that has an NLRB compliant handbook as of today, unless somebody rewrote it since last Tuesday. Thanks, Jim. Protected concerted activity, big topic. You want to just quickly outline what that is for those people who may not deal with it on a regular basis?
Right, and it's a good thing to look up on. There are a few definitions on the web that everybody should look at. Generally speaking, protected and concerted activity through the National Labor Relations Act gives employees the right to collectively, as an association, bring issues and talk about issues, compare issues among themselves. I think probably historically, Michael, the most common handbook as well as practical violation of protected concerted activity has been when an employer tells hourly employees that they cannot discuss their wages, and the NLRB clearly gives employees the right to discuss their wages with the idea that they could eventually collectively bargain for wages. And I don't think any of us in this business, none of us really want to repeal the NLRA. I think it's just a matter of understanding its application, and I think that most HR professionals will actually consider that a good law to protect people to collective bargaining. That's not so much where the rubber meets the road. It is legal compliance. We know that union-free is much more about treatment and employee engagement.
Yeah, the kind of environment you build, your culture, how you treat your people. And then to get into labor's lexicon, do you treat your people with dignity and respect and all those kind of things? Jim, protected concerted activity, it's all over the place right now, but we're seeing it in the news all over. There's been the oil refinery strike. There's some other things going on. But you live in South Carolina, and so there's a fairly big election scheduled. You want to talk quickly about the Charleston situation?
Sure. Early last week, the International Association of Machinists filed a petition for an election with Boeing South Carolina. Some of you may know Boeing started building a facility here over 8 years ago, originally subcontracted to two groups, but now Boeing owns the entire complex. This is where they have a production site for manufacturing site for the 787 jet, which is high tech, just an outstanding plane. IAM has been looking at Boeing for quite a few years. They actually were successful in organizing a piece of when it was a subcontracted unit, organizing a piece called Vought Aircraft. After Boeing acquired Vought, the employees had a window to decertify the union, and they did. So the IAM has been out. Boeing's been union-free. Then it's been expanding like mad. But now the IAM has filed a petition for an election. The election date is April the 22nd. And the issues, per statements from both Boeing and the Machinist Union in the papers, have to do with overtime. Generally, the IAM is saying there are treatment issues, and also they point to wage issues. What's interesting about the petition, the Machinist Union has been touting a unit size of 2,400 in the last month or so is what they're targeting. The unit ends up to be over 3,000 people because I think the union probably did not understand the scope of the unit and the fact that there are multiple operating facilities, not just one site in the Charleston area. So Boeing was successful in a broader unit, so it'll be very interesting to see what happened. Boeing was not does not appear to have been interested in dragging out any determinations. The stip for the election date came pretty quickly. So we're optimistic, but we just had to see, because publicly there have been some treatment issues voiced from employees, and hopefully Boeing has just an outstanding response. Something noteworthy I learned today, it's been many, many years since the Machinist Union was successful organizing any Boeing site, and I think it's been since 1946. I haven't researched it. I got that from an email from a friend this morning, but it has been a while since the Machinist Union has been successful with Boeing. So watch the papers. It'll be an interesting campaign. There are a couple of websites out there. If you do some searching about Boeing SC in particular, you'll see in Google search a map. There are a number of videos that Boeing has produced, and, of course, the IAM, Boeing South Carolina, has their own website, and you see counterpoints. Interesting campaign, very much social media driven, but a lot going on the plant floor, we're pretty sure.
And what I would say about that is, if you're listening and you think, you know, we're talking about the NLRB and we're talking about protected concern, all that boring old style labor relations stuff, look at Boeing, look at the International Association of Machinists, look at the level of contention that they've had for the last year, several years, especially over this South Carolina location. And you know, that's not, it may not be worst case scenario, but it's definitely it's been a very contentious campaign, and it's very likely where we're headed with the NLRB rule changes that are coming up April 14th, which are, I'll ask you about that in a second, Jim. You've had opportunity in your consulting business to be involved at least on or familiar with a couple other really interesting things to me. One was the Volkswagen situation in Chattanooga, which is the UAW and Volkswagen and some other groups trying to organize an automotive plant down there. You want to talk about that for a couple of seconds?
Sure, Mike. This Volkswagen Chattanooga campaign, which happened early 2014, actually had been going on for quite a while, unique because Volkswagen Chattanooga had a very robust neutrality agreement with the United Auto Workers and basically stayed silent for years, ever criticizing the idea of having a union presence in Chattanooga.
A neutrality agreement.
So the auto workers...
Jim, one sec. A neutrality agreement basically meaning the company had agreed to not actively contest the union's ability to try to organize their employees.
Thank you, Mike. And so what happened, the company itself actually filed a petition for an election in early February, and the time frame from petition to election was 10 days. I got involved with the campaign. I was asked by certain community people as well as an attorney and employees that formed a workers' center, a 501c4 not-for-profit workers' center where they were able to raise money from individuals and fund a counter-campaign. Because remember, Volkswagen stayed neutral. They weren't going to do any kind of a campaign. So we went in, and much to everybody's surprise, we won. Mike, I think you know the Wall Street Journal disclosed my involvement in the middle of the campaign, and of course I was personally criticized. But if you want to see, get an idea of some of the things we did in that campaign to win, the no2uaw.com website is still up there, and it's no2uaw.com. All the videos, all the flyers, everything we did is up there. One little interesting piece is because we had no access to the plant, we had no access to the employees other than trying to have public meetings. What we did was we developed a USB drive with three videos that were, quote, hand-billed, unquote, at the gate by the employees that did not want the union there. Major tipping point, and those videos are actually on that website if you're interested in seeing it. Now, this has evolved a little bit because the reality was Volkswagen wanted a union presence, not because of any particular relationship with the UAW, the auto workers, but because IG Metall, which is a German union, has a lot of power, has presence on Volkswagen's board, they were pushing the idea of having a union presence in Chattanooga so they could form what's called a European-style works council. Now, you'll see in our campaign, we were trying to point out you cannot do a works council in the United States like they do in Germany. In Germany, a works council works this way. The union negotiates wages and benefits, but there's a separate entity formed, which is a group, a team, if you will, of hourly employees, supervisors, some managers, some clerical technical people that may not be part of the unit. That separate entity actually deals with and will negotiate all other issues. In the United States, that becomes a little sticky because in the United States, a union cannot delegate its negotiating responsibilities to a separate entity. So that was an item during last year's campaign. But after the UAW lost, Volkswagen made it very, very clear they were still interested in having a union there. So the very team that led the anti-UAW effort formed their own union. They called it an association. The name of the union is American Council of Employees. This is a union that's almost not a union. It's an association of employees willing to negotiate, willing to do whatever they can legally to form a works council, but they're sticking to their principles from their old campaign. Their vision on their old campaign was they did not want Chattanooga to become Detroit, and they did not want the UAW having a presence in Chattanooga. They felt it was not in the best interest. But the counterintuitive piece of this is Volkswagen made very clear they were still interested in a union, so they formed this American Council of Employees called ACE. Now, since then, Volkswagen came up with a very interesting policy. They call it their engagement policy that's very public on the web, where they actually afford any organization, union, association, that if they can show a certain percentage of interest from employees, literally authorization cards, they could have meetings with management to discuss issues, not to collectively bargain, but to discuss. And as of today, the UAW claims they have 45% interest, so they have a certain tier, number of meetings they can have with management. ACE so far has 15% interest, and that has fewer meetings, but they can still meet with and talk with management. Putting the numbers together, it makes it pretty interesting. We haven't seen another petition from the UAW. They had 1 year before they could file another one. We haven't seen one, and if you do the math, 45 plus 15, and then assuming the balance of people that don't want anything to do with any kind of union, they probably can't win an election. So it's very interesting. UAW would prefer that Volkswagen voluntarily recognize a union. We don't think that's going to happen. But this has been an interesting story like nothing I've ever seen in my entire career. So stay tuned. There's plenty on the web about what's happened with Volkswagen. It's an interesting and unique proposition, but the fact that the employees won over the UAW last Valentine's Day 2014, they call it the Valentine Massacre, was a surprise to the entire industry and probably the most unique and probably highest profile labor union story in the past 50 years.
A very unprecedented type of development with that Volkswagen engagement policy, which essentially invites employee groups of a certain size to engage with management and discuss, to some extent, employment terms and conditions, although not as governed under the National Labor Relations Act. So it's a thing that people who do the work we do are keeping a very close eye on, because it could turn into some kind of new form of workplace representation in the U.S. Over time. We'll see. That's a story yet to be written. Thanks, Jim. I'm going to do a quick reset, which I just want to remind the audience. This is Michael Vandervoort. Today, as today's guest on Drive Through HR is Jim Gray, who's a longtime HR practitioner and now consultant in the world of labor relations. And we're talking about stuff like the Volkswagen organizing campaign by the UAW campaign to organize Volkswagen in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and the current election that's taking place down in Charleston, South Carolina, between Boeing and the International Association of Machine machinist. Jim, you also have been involved to some extent. We did some work together a couple months back with the fast food situation. You want to touch on that last kind of a little bit different turn on protected concerted activity to help? What can HR people do if they're in the retail or the fast food business?
Happy to, Mike. For the audience to know, about 4, maybe 5 years ago, Michael, you might remember the exact date, the SEIU published a white paper, if you will, on their strategy for organizing fast food or quick service restaurants. It was a very interesting proposition because what they wanted to do was start with pretty much social awareness to tap into the industry, knowing it's a very low-wage industry. And perhaps stealing a little bit of their playbook, going back to Justice for Janitors, which they were starting in Texas, very successful in organizing janitorial units, particularly units that were government contractors. They figured they have a golden opportunity with literally millions of crew members and quick service operations to organize. So their strategy started with forming these 501c4 not-for-profit worker centers. These are not labor organizations, but these organizations that the SAU is funding include names like Fight for 15, and Mike, you can name a number of others, I'm sure. That seems to be the one theme.
Yep.
Right. That's the one thing that seems to resonate. And what they're doing is they're a host of things. They're holding meetings in communities, talking to employees about their rights under the NLRB, protected concerted rights. They are starting protests where they're demanding higher wages. Fight for 15 means $15 an hour when the minimum wage, most of you know, is much less than that depending on the state. $7.25, I think, is pretty much the federal rate right now. But they're certainly making some big promises, and that $15 was actually developed sort of intuitively or spontaneously. We know that from the SEIU. But it's a real quandary because, to our knowledge, there hasn't really been a union organizing campaign yet, although we do know of some restaurants that have experienced some card signing. So it's unique in that we're well into this strategy, but we haven't seen any real tangible evidence of organizing. But a lot of things have happened. This coming April 15th, Fight for 15 and most of the other 501c4s have announced another public campaign. So watch the news. You'll see there will be protests around fast food restaurants, and now they're expanding that more into the general retail area. For HR people, though, particularly any of you in the audience that are in that industry or working in retail, probably the best focus right now is to help store managers know what to do should there be a protest outside their store or even in their store. It's very important to know how to respond and how to respond properly. And give a classic example: if an employee, an hourly employee at a fast food restaurant, wants to leave the organization, leave the restaurant briefly to join in one of those protests, I think most restaurant managers would think that would be a ticket for job abandonment and firing, and it's not. It's actually can be a part of protected activity. So we have to let our managers know the employees do have a right to engage in protests, and there's some exceptions to that, depending on the operation, the size. But generally, just, you know, what they're doing is they're literally joining in on a protest, protected activity, and it could be similar considering when somebody's joining a strike. You can't fire them. You certainly have the right to replace them, but you can't technically fire them. And these protests are orchestrated on purpose to be very short-term, not even an 8-hour protest, maybe just a few hours. And then the SEIU is watching when these people return to work. Are they being allowed to return? Are they being disciplined for returning? And unfortunately, there are multiple unfair labor practice charges that have been filed because of restaurant managers and retail managers that just don't know how to handle those situations. There is a good bit of advice out there on the web on what to do from labor attorneys, on what to do should such a protest happen at one of your operations. Do's and don'ts. And I encourage you to seek legal advice from your own labor council, but also check the web on many, many publications that are out there to assist in how to handle.
And this activity, April 15th, is going to be not just nationwide, many, many cities in the United States, but actually global. You mentioned retail, home health care workers. I saw Chicago teachers are getting involved. So it's whether it's orchestrated or not, it seems to be a movement that is gaining more and more media attention and making more and more noise, very, very successfully backed with union funds and public relations firms and advice and guidance. Restaurant owners, April 15th is going to be a big day. Take note. The other big event that's almost simultaneous, Jim, is the National Labor Relations Board changing the rules on election policies, and that happens on April 14th. You want to touch on that for just a minute? We're down to our last 5 minutes.
Sure, and I'll go over that pretty quickly because I'm going to assume that most of the audience, maybe not everybody, is aware of what we've been terming ambush elections. And generally, that is the speeding up of the election process from petition to election date. Traditionally, the average election period, campaign period, has been around 38 days. Now, with the new regulations coming out, it affords NLRB to go to a period of time that could be significantly shorter, possibly as little as 10 to 15 days. Any of you who have been through a campaign knows that the more time you have to give your side, the company's side, of what's going on, the more likely you are to win. The unions know the shorter the period of time, the more likely they are to win. So this was done certainly very much in the union's favor, but also part of the process is expediting all the paperwork, all the legal steps that have to happen prior to the actual determination and the election period. There's just a 7-day window where sometimes it takes weeks before all the terms and conditions of the campaign are decided. Most importantly, who is the proper unit? What is the proper unit? And who is within that unit? If you have team leads that may or may not be considered supervisors, those kind of determinations, the NLRB is trying to make that go very, very quickly, and sometimes even postponing decisions till after the election with the concept that we'll litigate that after the election if it would make a difference. So, again, very fast, quickie elections, sometimes they refer to it. It's a challenge. For those of you who hopefully are doing some things, some very common training, rapid response teams that are pre-trained to know what to do when they land and how to manage a campaign. Part of that team could also be partnering with a law firm, a good labor attorney, that can pre-prepare some of the paperwork that you know has to be done expeditiously just to get out of the way, because once a quickie campaign happens, you'll barely have time to think. You have to have all your strategies in place and act. And, of course, finally, Michael, most important lesson about the ambush election process is the best is not to have an election.
Right. Sorry, you're cutting in and out, Jim, for a second there. Yep, positive employee relations is the best practice. Listen, we're down to the last 90 seconds. One quick mention I wanted to make on NLRB rule changes. They're going to require the provision of additional information, including employee home addresses and phone numbers and emails, if you have them. And the thing is, though, that a lot of people collect emails for things like insurance or logging into portals for timekeeping. Lots of ways to get email addresses that you might not think of, even if you don't collect them in your database. Jim, we're down to the last 60 seconds. Thanks for being on the show. What last piece of advice or information would you like to share with the Drive-Thru HR audience today before we roll out of here?
Sure. Just a quick checklist of what I consider to be required reading or at least preferred reading. A book called Left of Boom by Phil Wilson, who I think has done this podcast before. Outstanding new book available on Amazon. Left of Boom tells you what to do in ambush campaigns and how to prevent an election ever happening. Shadow Bosses by Mallory Factor talks about corruption within unions. Very interesting book. HR from the Outside In by Dave Ulrich is the best HR strategy book I have ever read, and I've read very many. And finally, free on the web, I'd hate to see the author get any revenues from this, Rules for Radicals by Saul Alinsky. You can find the PDF.